First of all, welcome to the third and final of this week's sessions. We are in the third session of an exploration of, is anyone ever really possibly too far gone for tshuva? I'm going to do a very brief recap of what we've done so far this week. The first day we looked at a piece by the Netivot Shalom, who looked at the question of God hardening Pharaoh's heart and used that as a way to discuss whether anyone is ever really too far gone for tshuva. And he proposed the idea of what we translated as extraordinary tshuva. Tshuva that relies on spiritual forces, capabilities that we aren't usually aware that we have. Yesterday, we shifted gears and we looked at a midrash that talks about Pharaoh actually surviving the drowning of the Egyptians of the sea and going on to become the king of Nineveh. And as we looked at that midrash, we questioned, is Pharaoh in his next iteration of the king of Nineveh? Are we meant to understand him really as having changed or not? Can a Pharaoh really change? Today, we're going to be shifting gears slightly. We're not going to be discussing strictly, does tshuva always really work? Can a person really always change? Instead, we're going to be shifting gears to the perspective of, is someone always really forgivable? And do we always really have permission to forgive? What do I mean by that? I think many of us are familiar with teachings, and these are important teachings encoded in many Jewish sources, that talk about the importance of forgiveness. The idea that if someone comes to you and asks several times and they are really sincere, you have to forgive them. The idea that forgiveness, and the Rambam says this, is actually one of the character traits of a Jewish person, being willing to forgive. He sees it as the opposite of cold-heartedness or cruelty. And yet, I think we all have areas where we might look at them and say, well, if someone has done X, Y, and Z, should they be forgiven? Is it actually appropriate for someone to forgive someone who has done certain things? I'm going to ask us to take a moment to think about what areas are those? Meaning, I think we all have some imagination of, here are maybe where I can see the limits of forgiveness, the limits of forgiveness being appropriate. What might some of those scenarios be? And I'm going to invite people to think about that for a moment and put answers in the chat. Again, what are areas where we might think to ourselves, maybe in that case, forgiveness is not appropriate? Elizabeth Legat says, we are commanded never to forgive the Amalekites. That's very, very interesting and leads to a huge series of questions of why them particularly. Kelly McDowell, serial killers. Yeah, if someone does the most heinous thing or one of the most heinous things possible again and again, seemingly without remorse, what do you do? Is forgiveness really appropriate? Is it really possible? Sharon Heim says child sexual abuse, rape. Amalia Warshenbrot says Nazis with a question mark. That's interesting. For those of us who've read The Sunflower, a series of essays by different thinkers addressing the question of a Nazi who approaches a Jew in a concentration camp and asks for forgiveness before he dies. That question mark does a lot of work there. Sarah Brooks says, too many variables to think about, crime committed, psychology of the person, situations, etc. Yeah, this is really worth highlighting. Forgiveness or lack thereof is always individual. We can talk about categories, but in the end, we're talking about in the end, it always comes down to what happens between one human being and another. I'm going to read two more comments. Noka says, I have a hard time distinguishing between forgiving and trusting. When someone betrays trust, I often hear the distinction between forgiving without having to let them back into your life or allowing them to get close again. But it's hard for me to distinguish those two things. Great. We're not going to be going into depth with that today, but I think it's a point really worth highlighting. Is it possible to forgive without returning to a previous iteration of the relationship? It's really important. And then I want to read one last comment by Catherine Clark. We can't forgive a harm suffered by someone else. Now, that may feel very obvious to many of us. I want to highlight that for many human beings, it's not obvious. Has anyone, I'm sorry that in order to discuss this, we have to discuss terrible things. But sometimes, if you've ever read testimonies by parents of children who were killed by drunk drivers or by people who killed deliberately, one of the things you will sometimes see is the parent saying, I forgive them. Now, the question there becomes, are they forgiving on behalf of the child? Or are they forgiving the harm that was done to them as well? We might say, you know what? Maybe as the only living survivors, they have actually the ability, they have inherited the right to forgive even on behalf of the child. Or we might say, no, you can forgive the harm done to you. You can never forgive the harm done to someone else. We'll leave that question open as we explore some of the sources from today. I know I said that Catherine's comment would be the last comment, but I want to read what Robert said as well. Rav Heschel said that a murderer cannot be forgiven because only his victim, no longer alive, could forgive him. Great. We're going to be looking at some sources that point in that direction as well. Now, just so that we know what's coming, we're going to be looking at a series of sources that actually argue very much in this vein, very much in the vein of there are limits to what is possible with human forgiveness. There are limits to what is possible in human forgiveness because we cannot forgive on behalf of other people. And also, we'll look at an excerpt from a non-Jewish source, but I think important nonetheless. That also, I think, argues, and because sometimes the idea of forgiving some things might just be too obscene. We'll end with a piece that I think is absolutely beautiful by Rabbi Angela Buchdahl, who I think argues, and yet, even if the idea of forgiving this person might be too much, it is sometimes the best thing that you can possibly do for yourself. And we'll see how she articulates that. Let's jump into the source sheet and we'll get started. We're going to open with a piece from Rambam Hilchot Tshuva, Rambam in his treatise on the laws of Tshuva. If a person wronged another and the latter died before he could ask him for forgiveness, he should take 10 people and say the following while they are standing before the colleague's grave. I sinned against God, the Lord of Israel, and against this person by doing the following to him. Okay, let's take a look at this for a moment. There's something very interesting going on here. This person in the Rambam's case, it's not that this person killed the other person, which is the extreme form that we'll be looking at in some further sources today. But what is the case is that this person, the person who was wronged, died before this person was able to make amends with them. Now, the Rambam prescribes an interesting procedure here. the person who committed the wrong is to take 10 people and go stand at the grave of the person they wronged and make a public confession. And that public confession has to consist of two parts. One is, I did wrong before God. And the other is, I did wrong to this person. I want us to think about this for a moment, and I'm going to invite people again to use the chat. Why? What is the meaningful content of this gathering a minion, going to the grave and making this public declaration? They're not necessarily fixing anything. The person is still dead. The person maybe still cannot forgive them. What is the meaningful content? Why is the Rambam suggesting that they do this? What changes or what helps by going to the grave and making this public declaration? I'm also curious if anyone has ever actually heard of someone doing this in real life. I haven't, but I'm very curious. Sarah Brooks says the dead person's story is told. That's very beautiful. I want to expand on that for a moment. Sometimes part of the wrong done to someone else is that they have this part of their life where something really difficult and sometimes even terrible happened, and no one else knows that, and sometimes no one else believes that. Maybe in going and making this public declaration, actually that is at least making amends in that they are, in that the person who did the wrong is giving their story a more complete sort of telling in the world. Paula says, I see this as a way to make public confession, holding yourself accountable to the community. And John Marcus similarly says, healing the community. Great. Let's take a look at that for a moment. What's being suggested here is that a wrong is never actually just between two people. And the Rambam already hints at this in having the perpetrator say, I did wrong before God and this person. What we're essentially suggesting here in this kind of triangle is that there are always three who are wronged when someone commits a sin against another. There's the direct victim, there's God, and there's the community, whether or not the community knows that it's been harmed. And maybe even if the person is no longer able to forgive, at least God and the community may still have that capacity. Now, that leaves open the question, should God and the community forgive? And we're going to touch on that in a moment. I want to read one more response by Rabbi Sharon Perlman. The person clears out their heart of the weight they're carrying. Okay, great. This is a reading of the Rambam where it is not so much about the community can forgive, or about maybe in some way in the next world the victim is forgiving, but instead about what can this person do in order to move on in the world? What do they need in order to let go of what they did and try to move forward in life? Now, depending on the quality of the wrong that they did, how bad it was or it wasn't, we might feel like this is something deserved. We might feel like, no, actually, that's an easy way out. But it is still important to remember that aspect. Let's go on. We're going to now jump to a very different view of what can be done when the person who you have wronged is gone, when the person you have wronged is dead and is no longer there to forgive. This is from the Midbar 35, and it concerns the laws of the cities of refuge. Let's do a moment of just background outside. What are the cities of refuge? The Torah commands that when the Jewish people enter the land of Israel, they are to put aside certain cities of refuge where if someone kills someone else accidentally, Accidentally is an important word here. It's hard to define. It seems that, at least according to rabbinic explanation, this is not something that's completely an accident, but it cannot be a deliberate murder either. Usually it seems that this is some sort of criminal negligence, you might say. If someone kills someone else accidentally, they are entitled to run to these cities of refuge and there be safe from any sort of retribution by the victim's family. And they remain there until the current Kohen Gadol, the current high priest, dies. On the one hand, that is incredibly forgiving, we might say. Yeah, you took another life, but we recognize that this was not entirely your fault. We are going to provide protection. But there's an important note towards the end of the Torah's laws of what happens to this person. And I want us to scroll down a little bit so that we can see that important note and discuss why it's there. Let's go to verse 30. If anyone kills another, the murderer shall be put to death on the evidence of witnesses. This is if it is done deliberately. If someone else kills another person deliberately, the Torah prescribes the death penalty if there are witnesses to the fact. But no one shall be put to death on the testimony of a single witness. One witness is never enough. Moreover, and I want us to pay attention here, you shall accept no ransom for the life of a murderer who is subject to the death penalty. A murderer must be put to death. What can you never do? You can never accept what the Torah calls a ransom, and we'll talk about what that is in a moment, for a murder. Meaning, if the murderer says, I will pay the victim's family hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, anything, for them to forgive me so that I don't have to undergo the death penalty, so that I won't be killed. In many cultures, that might be considered an acceptable thing. The Torah looks at this and says, absolutely not. You can never do that. You can never accept a ransom in order to allow the murderer to live. The victim's family actually does not have the right to do that. And I want us to think about, and we'll talk about this in a moment, why? Why does the victim's family not have that right? Nor, and this I think is even more surprising, shall you accept ransom for one who has fled to a city of refuge, enabling the fugitive to return to the land before the death of the high priest. Even someone who killed accidentally, even someone who killed because of negligence, an accident, something along those lines, you might think, well, that person, what they did wasn't really evil. It was tragic, but not evil. Even then, you cannot accept a ransom, allowing them to leave the city of refuge before its time, allowing them just to go out and live in the general land again. Why? The Torah says, you shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land, for the blood that is shed in it, except by the blood of the one who shed it. This is a theology that I don't think most of us think about very often, a theology of land. What does it mean? It's offering a way of looking at the world in which actually causing the death of another human being does not only harm that human being, does not only harm the family, but harms the very fabric of the world in which we live. The blood pollutes the land. There is some idea there that the very land that we walk on, by virtue of having had that victim's blood shed upon it, has been polluted, and the land itself cannot tolerate the murderer to just be free to walk around in it. Now, I want us to hold that for a moment. On the one hand, that might feel like a very foreign idea. That might feel like a foreign idea because we don't usually think about land as something that can necessarily be corrupted by blood, by human actions. But on the other hand, there's something about it that may be a little bit intuitive. When someone does something terrible, we sometimes have the feeling that the very world around us has been corrupted, that there's something in the fabric of our world that no longer feels as whole, no longer feels as innocent as it did before. And this might be a way of saying, and no matter what you might want to do, even if you want to forgive, you can't just wave that away. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in which I also dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the Israelites. Okay, let's take a beat. What did we just see in this text? This text just expressed an idea that there are some things, particularly murder, that cannot be forgiven. Why? Not only for the reasons we pointed out at the beginning, that only the victim can really forgive, but because the land itself, the world itself, has been corrupted somehow by this action, and you can't just ignore that. I want to ask people, and I see that people are already doing this, to put reactions to that in the chat. How does that land with you? Does it feel intuitive to you? How does that feel to you? How does that resonate or not resonate with you? Do you feel that there are things that people do in this world that are beyond your capacity to live because they in some way pollute the very world in which we live? I'm going to read some responses from the chat. Amy Melman says it cheapens the life of the person who was killed. Yeah, and I want to come back to that. There's something there that's not just about that person is no longer there to forgive, and therefore we don't have the authority to forgive. There's something that's also seems to be about this is a human life we're talking about. Can you really forgive the taking of a human life, or does any sort of forgiving of that actually cheapen the value of life itself? That's very different from, do we have a right to forgive on behalf of someone else? It's a way of speaking about, are some things actually too heinous to be forgiven because they dilute the value of what there was before? Sarah Brooks, murder is a crime against God. It's in the first half of the Ten Commandments. Great. So maybe the talking about the land being corrupted is a way of talking about God has been sinned against here, not just the family, not just the victim, God itself. Rabbi Sharon Perlman, your brother's blood calls out from the land, Cain. Yes, very resonant. And the land can't hold the sadness. Yeah. And Sarah Brooks comments something very similar to what my reaction was here. I think many of us have been in places where our awareness of the atrocities that took place there make us feel like the very earth is corrupted with it. I'm going to read a few more responses from the chat. Robert says, I wonder if land here refers equally to the community that inhabits the land, and whether this and or related teachings support capital punishment for deliberate, as in premeditated, murder. Great, let's talk about this for a moment. The land, what if that really means the community? Now, what might that mean in context? It might mean, no, the victim's family does not have the right to forgive this because they were not the only ones wronged. Who else was wronged? Everyone who knew and loved the victim, everyone who interacted with the victim, but more than that, everyone who has to wake up the next day, day after day, to the reality of a world in which such a terrible thing happened, everyone who has to face that reality day after day, everyone who has to understand that their community is not as quote unquote innocent as they once might have imagined that it was. And this might be a way of saying, take seriously what it means when a human life is taken. Its effects are never confined just to that person, just to a family. The effects go far beyond what we could ever imagine and are suffused so deep that it is as if it is in the land itself. Let's take a look at one more comment. Elisheva Miller says, I wonder what other hurts might fall into this category, specifically ones that are less public or with less obvious results to people other than the victim. Great. I love, love, love that comment. This is a complicated thing to say, but in some ways it's easiest to talk about this question when it comes to murder. Meaning we all know very obviously how awful that is. Its effects are obvious. And there are also other crimes that happen that we talk about less, often because we feel like we don't have the ability to talk about them or we don't have all the words to talk about them, whose effects do similar things, whose effects seep into not just the victim themselves, but the victim's family, the victim's friends, the very community itself. It may feel sometimes like the very earth on which it happened and makes it feel like it's impossible just to say, well, one person has the right to forgive that. Let's keep going. I want us to take a look at a very different way of articulating this intuition, articulating the intuition that sometimes there are things that actually are not in our capacity to forgive. Not in our capacity to forgive either because we are not the primary victim, or not in our capacity to forgive because they are actually just, I would say, too large, too heinous for human forgiveness. And there is maybe something even a little bit obscene about the idea that a human being should forgive this. This is from the Brothers Karamazov. It is Ivan speaking. And he's speaking for those of us who've read the Brothers Karamazov. If not, this stands alone, don't worry. And what you have here is someone speaking out against the idea that it is actually the height of religiosity for someone to always be willing to forgive. And he's specifically talking about the expectation that a mother whose child was killed should forgive the victims in the name of what I'll call harmony, in the name of religious forgiveness, in the name of values that we so often call spiritual heights. Let's take a look at this. The Brothers Karamazov. Oh, Alyosha, I am not blaspheming. I understand, of course, what an upheaval of the universe it is when everything in heaven and earth blends in one hymn of praise and everything that lives and has lived cries out loud, Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed. Let's pause for a moment. This is a dense text, but something important already just happened. What Ivan is speaking about here is the idea that often lurks in the back of our minds, that in forgiving, we are actually doing something that is praiseworthy because we are also making our peace with the fact that God allowed this to happen. That in forgiving the person who did wrong, we are in some way also perhaps forgiving God for whatever hurt we are harboring in our heart for the evil that happened, and then in some way making our spiritual universe whole again. And he's saying, I understand that. I understand that religious intuition. But when the mother embraces the fiend who threw her child to the dogs and all three cry aloud with tears, You are just, O Lord, then of course the crown of knowledge will be reached and all will be made clear. But what pulls me up here is that I can't accept that harmony. Ivan is saying, yes, I see what is very beautiful and touching about that. And I want to just bring this into the present day. This is a scene that repeats itself in courtrooms today, or in attempts at reconciliation between perpetrators and families of victims today. Newspapers love to print these stories. the parents of the victim come in, they tell the perpetrator that they forgive them, everyone cries, everyone makes their peace. And I don't want to devalue that because that is a sort of superhuman strength that I cannot imagine having. And I am in no position to judge someone who has that sort of strength and who has that some sort of belief. But, says Ivan in the text we're looking at right now, I'm looking at that and seeing that there is beauty there, but that's beauty that I cannot accept. And here's why. But what pulls me up here is that I can't accept that harmony. And while I am on earth, I make haste to take my own measures. You see, Alyosha, perhaps it really may happen that if I live to that moment or rise again to see it, I too perhaps may cry aloud with the rest, looking at the mother embracing the child's torture, thou art just, O Lord. But I don't want to cry aloud then. Let's pay attention to what just happened. Ivan is looking at this and saying, you know what? If I was in that courtroom seeing the mother embrace the child's murder, I also might look at that and in the moment feel moved to say, this is beautiful. This is the height of religiosity. This is the height of spirituality. Because I'm a human being and I am moved by things like that. But I don't want to be because I don't think that it's right. While there is still time, I hasten to protect myself. And so I renounce the higher harmony altogether. It's not worth the tears of that one tortured child who beat itself on the breast with its little fist and prayed in its stinking outhouse with its unexpiated tears to dear kind God. It is not worth it because those tears are unatoned for. What's Ivan saying here? Ivan is saying, that moment of beauty, that moment of forgiveness, that moment of spiritual high does not actually in any way make up for, change, or do anything about the tears that the child cried. And there is nothing in the world that can make up for those tears. Now, I really want us to pay attention to what Ivan is doing here because he's talking about how often we can be seduced by the beauty of forgiveness. The beauty of forgiveness, the spiritual high that we get from forgiveness, especially from seeing, I would say, other people forgive. And the way it sometimes makes us forget about the actual suffering of the victim. And Ivan is saying, yes, we can get swept up in that moment. And yes, I too am attracted to that moment. I'm attracted to the idea that everything can be made whole. Because that's really what forgiveness, or at least some forms of forgiveness, are at the end of the day. They're a belief, they're part of a belief that nothing in this world is ever completely unhealable. That maybe even in the worst moments, there are parts that we can heal through our power of forgiveness. But he's saying, in order to embrace that truth, sometimes what it requires from us is actually to ignore the suffering that actually happened. We're buying that beauty at the cost of forgetting about the victim. And that, he said, that he argues, is never, ever worth it. It's a sort of spiritual lie. I don't want the mother to embrace the oppressor who threw her sons to the dogs. She dare not forgive him. Let her forgive him for herself if she will. Let her forgive the torture for the immeasurable suffering of her mother's heart. But the sufferings of her tortured child, she has no right to forgive. She dare not forgive the torture, even if the child were to forgive him. Here we have Ivan touching on an idea that we brought up at the very start. There are some things that only the victim can forgive, and the victim is no longer here. And he's saying, and even if the child were to stand there somehow miraculously alive and forgive, that still wouldn't give the mother the right to forgive on behalf of the child. And if that is so, if they dare not forgive, what becomes of harmony? Is there in the whole world a being that would have the right to forgive and could forgive? I don't want harmony. From a love of humanity, I don't want it. And I want us to pay attention to this. He say, part of what Ivan is saying here is, yes, so often we think of forgiveness under all circumstances and it's an act of supreme love. But actually, sometimes it's love of humanity that makes us say, no, I cannot forgive. I cannot forgive because I love humanity and I love in that humanity the person whose suffering you caused, and therefore I do not have a right to forgive it. On behalf of humanity, I do not have a right to forgive it. I would rather be left with the unavenged suffering. I would rather remain with my unavenged suffering and unsatisfied indignation, even if I were wrong. Besides, too high a price is asked for harmony. It's beyond our means to pay so much to enter on it. And so I hasten to give back my entrance ticket. And if I am an honest man, I am bound to give it back as soon as possible. And that I am doing. It is not God that I don't accept Alyosha. Only I most respectfully return to him the ticket. Do you agree with Ivan that there are things that we cannot forgive? Do you agree with Ivan that there are things that are actually obscene to forgive? Do you share his suspicion of the ways we sometimes deploy forgiveness, that it is deployed in order to allow us to get to what I'll call a false spiritual sense of stability? Or do you look at this and say, no, there's something important that Ivan is missing here? I want to read one comment from Ron Miroff that came in before when we were talking about the sort of crimes that affect the whole community. Ron Miroff says, makes me think about clergy abuse and how their crimes cause such devastating pain for those they harmed and often causes them and their communities to feel alienated from God and Torah and Israel. I know that that was a response to the previous text, but I think it's so important to put out there. Okay, looking at responses to this text, to Ivan's monologue, Judith Hellerstein says, there's a difference between forgiveness and forgetting. We may be able to forgive, but not forget what happened. Great. Ivan is conflating in some ways two things here, forgiving and forgetting, or forgiving and acting like, okay, now everything is fine. Maybe there is some way actually for the mother to say, I forgive, and also to say, I will always remember what happened to my child, and I will always hold that in my heart, and I will not overlook that. Maybe there is some way actually for both to live together and thus to avoid what I'll call this kind of saccharine false moment of spiritual reconciliation bought by overlooking the child's suffering. Maybe. Sarah Brooks, I have trouble with the phrase offered to a mourner, God is the true judge. Something very beautiful that someone once told me was that in its earliest iterations, that was only ever supposed to be said by the mourner themselves, not by other people to the mourner. Because in some ways, it's maybe a little bit obscene for other people to say that to someone who's just suffered a loss. Robert, regarding Judith's post, Ed Koch used to say that he could forgive, but never forgot. Sasha says, I think of people who are still in families with the perpetrator and feel pressured to forgive. Yes. Bracha Lieberman, sounds like it can be a cheap assuaging, but not redemptive high. Meridale Allen, I like to distinguish between forgiving the person, but not the act. We'll come back to that. And Emily Labaton, I really want to read this out loud because I think it says so much of what we all are feeling. So painful. Yeah, it is. This is one of the more heart-rending texts, I think, that we have on this subject. I want to read one more response here by Robert Bennett. My son was able to forgive the person who harmed him during his childhood. Is this spiritual height or pathology? I think it is wonderful. I want to say that I admire your son so much for the ability to do that, and I really want to highlight I think that there is something so different between a person doing that on behalf of themselves and a person doing that on behalf of someone else. Shoshana Michael Zucker offers, perhaps we need another word for moving past the hurt, but not forgiving. I love that. I love that. And it also makes me think about how our English vocabulary of forgiveness is so poor. Hebrew has many different words for atonement, for different types of forgiveness, for different stages of that process. English does not. One more comment, and then we'll go on to Forgiveness is a Prayer by Rabbi Buchdahl. Robert says, I don't know if these ruminations will be helpful, but in the end, I wonder whether forgiveness actually matters. That is, does it matter to those in need of forgiveness? My impression is that those most in need of forgiveness for vile crimes don't care whether they're forgiven or not. Just as contrary to writers given to romanticizing, they don't have any problem getting a good night's sleep. Great. And that brings up the question of, is forgiveness for the perpetrator or is forgiveness for us? We're about to see Rabbi Buchdahl's essay on the subject. She is not specifically writing about categories of things that we might call unforgivable, but I do think she gives a perspective on what forgiveness might be that may allow us to apply it to the things we might usually say are unforgivable and talk about maybe this is unforgivable, and yet maybe for my own sake, I need to at least try to forgive. Let's jump into the essay. This is called Forgiveness is a Prayer, and I believe it was Rabbi Buchdahl's Yom Kippur Drasha. Often the most challenging parts of offering forgiveness is the sense that the offender doesn't deserve and hasn't earned our forgiveness. But forgiveness is not about what you are offering someone else. It's what you give yourself. Forgiveness is a decision about how you want to live. It's taking control of how much power you allow someone else's sin to have over you. It is a mistake to confuse forgiveness with justice, to think that withholding your forgiveness is a form of punishment for the person who hurt you. In fact, the opposite is often true. As the saying goes, holding on to anger is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. It never works that way. Okay, let's make sure we're following what Rabbi Buchdahl is doing here, because there's a lot going on. First of all, Rabbi Buchdahl is talking about a way of thinking in which we might separate our internal forgiveness from what the other person needs or deserves or has merited, and in which we can separate our internal forgiveness from justice. Meaning, there might still be, first of all, the question of does this person deserve the forgiveness or not is not really part of the equation. And second of all, in which any process of justice for the other person is not halted or changed by my forgiveness. To apply this back to the text we saw about the cities of refuge, yes, maybe in fact it might be very good for the family's own mental health, spiritual, emotional health, for them to say, I am going to let go, I am going to forgive. And yet that does not mean that the murderer goes free. Justice and forgiveness here, Rabbi Buchdahl are proposing, are two separate things. And why? Because forgiveness is about not the perpetrator, but the person who has been wronged. Again and again, I see the burdens that people carry when they choose not to forgive. Pain, betrayal, and humiliation can occupy so much psychic real estate in our brains. We hold on to slights we've endured at the hands of our family, coworkers, and friends who excluded us, judged us unfairly, took undue credit, or were unappreciative. We have been undermined, cheated, lied to. We've been scarred by emotional or even physical abuse. We have real grievances. And I love that line because so often we confuse forgiveness with saying, well, what happened to me doesn't really matter. It wasn't that really that big of a deal. And Rabbi Buchtel is saying that's not what forgiveness is. Forgiveness requires or includes saying this was real and this was terrible. And also, maybe it's possible to forgive. And our tradition understands the limits of forgiveness. But we also must ask while the gates are open, what would be possible if we could forgive? Let's keep going. On Yom Kippur afternoon, we will read in our Machzor the words of Rabbi Baruch of Mezbish. To attain truth, one must pass through gates, each opening to a new question, the last question beyond which one cannot live without faith. I love this as a metaphor, not just for obtaining truth, but forgiveness as well. Because we all know that forgiving isn't fast. It doesn't happen in an instant. It is an intention of unlocking a gate that may feel irrevocably shut, of opening it tentatively, putting one foot in front of the other to walk through, sometimes with great effort, all the time asking, is the person who hurt me really remorseful? Has this person changed? Let's just really pay attention here. What Rabbi Buchtel here is describing is forgiveness as a process, forgiveness as a road that we walk, opening a new gate each and every time. And one that's often plagued by doubts. This isn't what I'll call easy forgiveness. It's not cheap forgiveness. It's not the public spectacle of a spiritual high of forgiveness. It's a difficult internal road that we walk, sometimes wondering if it's even possible. And aside from if it's even possible, if it's even just, if it's even appropriate. And each time we see the person who injured us, each time we have to relive our loss, our humiliation, our betrayal, our pain, we stand at a threshold and are hit with new questions. Why am I still holding on to this anger? What burden will I continue to bear if I do not forgive? Could forgiveness be a gateway to a life of greater peace? It is said that when God ascends the throne of judgment on Rosh Hashanah, that God also prays. What is it that God prays for? While God is seated in judgment, God prays for compassion and the ability to overcome anger so that God can be more forgiving. Forgiveness is a hope and aspiration. Forgiveness is a prayer, even for God, maybe for all of us. I want to repeat that last line. Forgiveness is a prayer, even for God, maybe for all of us. Rabbi Buchtel doesn't leave us with easy answers about should we forgive? Is everything forgivable? Is anything beyond forgiveness? And she also doesn't lie. She's not saying forgiveness is easy if you just put your mind to it. Forgiveness is always possible. But what she does offer is the idea of forgiveness as a prayer. Our prayers aren't always answered. I think all of us have prayers that are about things we have not yet achieved in life. But they do point us in the direction of the things we want most desperately and the people we most want to be. And maybe when it comes to things like this, maybe when it comes to the things we are not sure if they should be forgiven, the things we are not sure if we're capable of forgiving, maybe just the prayer of forgiveness is enough.